Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Murder 123. We got a great show tonight. The whole crowd is with us, and it's going to be exciting. I'm Dr. John Stamey, live from the vacation capital of the East Coast, Myrtle Beach. We've got here with us, ladies first, of course, from South Carolina, Robin McCray. How are you doing tonight?
I'm great. How are you?
Well, I'm excited, a little scared. Got my Bible with me. I'm telling you that we got a live one here. I'll tell you that. But we're glad to have you. And I got to say to everybody, thanks for being on our new little podcast, ElChupacabra.mx. We're dealing in the Chupacabra now, hadn't had enough publicity. So thanks for being on there with us tonight. It was great. And back, and we're so glad he's here. One of our favorite people on the West Coast and anywhere, Devin Tate. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. I am just recovering from a dental appointment. I just had a filling put in a tooth, and unfortunately I have some more really fun dental work coming up soon. But everything else is good out here on a chilly March night in Los Angeles.
Buddy, it's freezing in Myrtle Beach. I know what you mean. We're so glad you're with us tonight, and so glad to have you here. From Harlan County, Kentucky, the murder capital of the world, Tony Pelosi. How are you doing, Tony?
I'm doing fine, but I think we'll have to give that to Herman Mudgett, the murder, at least the murder, the biggest mass murder in the world, in my opinion.
Well, I'll tell you what. Pardon my grammar, everybody. This man was a true bastard. This is one of the meanest men that may have ever lived. I mean, he's right there with Genghis Khan and Vladimir the Impaler. And I'm telling you, this is like beyond the pale of anything I've ever seen. Don Burkowski introduced me to H.H. Holmes. I really didn't know about him. And I decided, well, if Burkowski thinks he's that bad, we're going to look into him tonight. And I couldn't believe what I found out. I couldn't stop reading. So here goes the story. And as our A-plus panel knows, stop when you have a comment. Now, first of all, in 1861, this is the, we're right in the Civil War. The beginning of the Civil War, a little dude named Herman Mudgett. Now, that just doesn't sound like anyone that's going to be something like this. He was born into a family with five children up in Vermont. I mean, nothing exciting here. His dad was a farmer. We really don't know a whole lot about his childhood, other than there were some rumors that he had some super harsh treatment from his dad. But that's really never been verified. We don't really have a lot of information from his four brothers and sisters. Now, when he was 17, he had graduated from high school. That would have been about 1878. He graduated from high school and became a teacher, because back then you could do that. High school was about as high as you could get. There really weren't that many colleges. And he married his first wife, Clara. Now, in 1880, when he was 19 years old, he studied and became a CPA. Now, in 1882, he enrolled in medical school at the University of Virginia, and he graduated. Now, he was known to treat Clara very badly. People back then didn't always own their own house or have apartments. They lived with people. And the folks that he lived with said that he was constantly terrible to her, beat her, and everything. Well, ultimately, the couple moved to New York, and after he had finished medical school, and he was frequently seen in the company of a small boy. And one day, that boy vanished. People were used to seeing Herman walking around holding the boy's hand. And there were some questions. Herman said, well, the boy went back to family in Massachusetts, I'm sure. So no real investigation really ever took place, but he took a powder, and he left town immediately from that upstate New York location where he was. Herman moved to Pennsylvania, where he became, because he had graduated from medical school, he became a pharmacist. Now, while he was working at this pharmacy in this no-name little town in Pennsylvania, a boy died after taking medicine that his parents had gotten for him at the store. Now, he didn't deny any connection with the death of that little kid, but he left town immediately. Now, it's starting to get a little iffy here. He then decided to move to Chicago, and he changed his name to Henry Howard Holmes so that he could avoid the possibility of being exposed for kind of being in and around the death of a couple kids. And so, you know, whatever those deaths might have been, he just wanted to do that. And he left Clara back in Pennsylvania because he needed to make his fortune to bring her out there. Well, he got out there, and in 1886, he's still married to Clara, and he married this girl named Murta Belknap. She was up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And so then he brought her down. And so at that point, he filed for divorce from Clara there in Illinois a few weeks after he married Murta, but because there was no evidence or anything, that case was thrown out. He said she had been going with another man, but he was never able to prove it. So that was gone. So now here we are. Herman, now H.H. Holmes, is married to two women. He was a bigamist for sure. He was married to a lot of women. So then in 1894, just something on over, he was out in Denver, Colorado, and he married a girl named Georgiana Yoke. I mean, he married three ladies and made advances and had girlfriends, at least six more. Now, not all of them remain to tell the story, so we'll see what happens. So in 1889, he and Murta had a daughter, and she grew up, and ultimately he lived with them for about 20 years. They lived in a little town called Englewood, Illinois. Now, Devin, they got a place called Englewood, California, right?
We do. It's spelled with an I, not an E.
Yeah, they wanted to stay as far away from H.H. Holmes as they could, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So anyway, he lived with Murta and his daughter, and he spent most of his time, though, in Chicago to tend to business. Now, we'll find out about that business. But anyway, so in Englewood, he purchased a drugstore, and it was a building that was like three stories tall from the doctor Holton and his wife, and that was in 1887. He conned a bunch of businesses out of furniture, and then he decided to build a brand new building directly across the street. The new building, it was weird. It had secret rooms, secret hallways, soundproof rooms, and as I said, halls that just went nowhere. Well, we'll find out what was going on there. He took on his first real mistress. Her name was Julia Smith, and she and her daughter disappeared in Christmas of 1891. No one ever saw him again. Wonder what happened. He later claimed that she died because he was a doctor, he was performing an abortion, and that was before there was anything illegal about an abortion. It was just a regular procedure that some surgeons would take on to do. He then took on this girl named Emmeline, and she began working in the building the next year in 1892. She disappeared that December, so she had about 6 months before she vanished into thin air. We'll find out about thin air. Then came Edna Van Tassel. She was another girlfriend, and she's believed to be one of his victims as well. Not only right there, he's got three victims that just disappeared like magic, and then he had three wives, and it was just kind of getting crazy. He was also, at the time, an entrepreneur, and so he continued to build furniture and fixtures and everything from local businesses, but they started getting wise to him. But the Chicago area was thrilled because here came the 1892 Colombian World Expo in Chicago, honoring, because, you know, 1492 was the year attributed to Christopher Columbus. So it was the Colombian World Expo in Chicago. There were thousands of people who came to Chicago. And he had a third floor, which in his buildings that he used as hotels. Now, nobody can have any idea how many people evaporated once they came to his hotel. I mean, I've got a coloring book. It's called Serial Colors. And it's, and here's a copy of his ad. It said, "The World's Fair Hotel, a good time for the whole family." Uh-huh. Now, Tony has told me twice today that he has some reflections on H.H. Holmes. Is this a good time for you to reflect, kind sir?
I can reflect somewhat, yes.
Thank you. Let's reflect.
From what I've read about Holmes and some of the documentaries that I've watched, this guy was evil incarnate. He did not care if it was children, women, men. He had no compunction about who he killed or how many he killed. The murder castle with the gas lines in it, that whenever the police finally went in and arrested him, and in the, well, they didn't arrest him in the murder castle, they arrested him another murder, with, I think, murder of Pfizer, what's the guy's name, his partner's name?
Well, yeah, we'll talk about him in just a little bit.
Yeah,
that's because he builds these houses, he builds these second building, he outfits them for torture and murder, and that's only chapter one in the life of H.H. Holmes.
And incinerators. And he also sold, if I'm not mistaken, you know, he had incinerators under the guise of gas blowing. And didn't he own another property in the Chicago area, allegedly, that had some more incinerators, some sort of glass blowing factory?
He owned tons of properties. I mean, he was a heck of an entrepreneur. I mean, this is back in the time you could just walk in with a letter of credit. They wouldn't even know if it was real. And you could do anything you wanted. This was before Social Security numbers. This was before, you know, anything. And he could obviously talk. He was a silver tongue devil, not just a devil. And he could really talk about this. And I mean, and now Robin was saying in our green room before the show that this man was evil incarnate. Robin, tell us about your feelings of this,
well,
of this
Tony
man.
Said too. Yeah, Tony said the same thing, but when we were getting ready, I was going over what the notes that you had sent me. And normally, you know, I'll get a feel or a read on somebody. This was completely different. I got a physical negative reaction from this person. Okay, so that tells me that he is far worse than anything that we normally on this show have ever encountered. I mean, this man was evil beyond evil. He literally has turned murdering people into a money-making scheme. This was deliberate. He sold body parts. He sold their skin. He sold their flesh.
He sold their bones to medical schools.
He did.
Yeah,
he did. These were not human beings. These were assets to sell, just like if you owned a store that sold groceries. You're going to order your produce in or whatever, going to sell it out to people, which is what you do. That's all he thought about with a human life. This man was evil to his core, to the point where he's borderline demonic. And I don't, anybody that knows me knows I don't come up with the whole demonic thing very often because
you
there's a big difference in demonic, never, because there's a difference in demonic and evil. Okay? You can be evil and not be demonic. Demonic comes from the underworld. This man was demonic. He was driven by evil to his core. He was not like a normal human being, even a bad or an evil human being. He went far below that. And as soon as I saw, it was very odd because as soon as I opened up the email with the information about him, I wasn't even into the first paragraph. And I had a tightness in my chest. I had fear in my chest. I could feel it in my back. I could feel it in my arms. I mean, just a complete physical reaction to this person. And that was only within the first paragraph.
Well, what I can tell you, and this is what I believe, and this is going to follow up with a question to Devin. And I think, Devin, you'll have some interesting thoughts on this. I think the more people you – in other words, when you have smaller and smaller communities, you normally don't have any type of behavior like this because of the smaller communities and, say, the expectations. We don't see much like that. But this boy barreled his way out of Vermont – and he goes to Chicago, which is one of the largest cities. I mean, like what we can say, Los Angeles, Devin. It's one of the largest cities in the world. And you know, we don't really have people. I'm from Morganton, North Carolina. I don't even know that we've ever had a murder in Morganton other than a couple boys getting mad at each other and pulling knives at a bar. I don't think we've ever really had a murderer in a lot of these smaller towns. But, Devin, you know, I mean, you know, you're out there in L.A., and you got people like Charles Manson. You've got the Black Dahlia murder. You know, do you, off the top of your head, do you know some of the other – there have been a lot of murders out there in Los Angeles, correct?
Yeah, Richard Ramirez comes to mind. And there was a what do they call him? There was that one guy who had he killed prostitutes, and he took a long break. The Grim Sleeper is what they called him, because he there was like a 20-year break in between his killings.
Yeah, and then here comes of course Jack the Ripper. I mean, you look, large cities will tend to have places, will tend to have the environment where murderers and real criminals can just get lost. They can't get lost, I'll tell you what, they can't get lost in Myrtle Beach. We only have 60,000 people in the whole Grand Strand, you know?
Yeah, and you know, the interesting thing about H.H. Holmes is this is all, a lot of this is documented in a book called Devil in the White City. I don't know if any of you have read it, but it's really, really good. And it takes a look at H.H. Holmes kind of concurrently with the people that were setting up the World's Fair in Chicago. So it contrasts the two different plots that are going on there. But, you know, it was such an exciting time because that World's Fair introduced a ton of the things that we have come to know and love, you know, products and things. The Ferris wheel was introduced at that World's Fair. So I think there was kind of this exciting feeling that amplified what everybody was already thinking. So unfortunately, when you have somebody like H.H. Holmes in that situation, he kind of got amplified to just become an even huger monster than he ever had been.
Well, now Devin, I hate to contradict you, but are you telling me that the Ferris wheel was introduced then, and the Ferris wheel didn't come out in 1998 in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina? Are you telling me that?
I sure am.
Okay, I'll believe you. I trust you. You're not a liar. I think you're factually correct. I was talking, of course, about the Sky Wheel under which we work every summer. So, yeah, that's my little attempt. I'm sorry, but you know what? I would like, if you would text me the name of that book when the show's over, I'd like to take a look at it, and maybe we can get Dave Bukowski on here to talk about H.H. Holmes, because this is not a story that we cannot cover this in 90 minutes tonight on Murder 123. There's so much about it. It's like it took us two stories and a surgeon to care of people. Gaskins, and we still have questions about that boy. But you know, it's amazing, the more we study these things, the more we find out. And as I said, little small towns don't have people like this, but larger towns tend to. Ramirez, I mean, Manson, I mean, those people out there. What happened? And I'll get on to my story, and then I think we have a lot to discuss. All right, here he is. He's married to three people, three women. Who knows? He'd have been married to a man if it had been legal, probably. So he ended up in jail for just a little bit. He came back out. Then he had an office in the Chemical Bank building in Chicago, and he met a guy named Benjamin Pitzel. He was a carpenter. He had a criminal past. And in that building, when he met him, he was exhibiting, now get this, a special coal bin, basically a great place to drop a few bodies. So what happened is Holmes met him and they became real accomplices. They became best friends. Holmes would tell him what to do, and he would do it. And Holmes had a little bit of a grand plan to make a lot of money. And he counted on Pitzel. Pitzel was kind of his go-to, like from Frankenstein, he was his Igor. No, casting aspersions on the great Dr. Igor Berzel. But anyway, so in 1893, a gal named Minnie Williams, an actress from New York, she moved to Chicago, and he offered her a job. Now he's got three wives and all this. So she was going to be his personal stenographer. And of course she accepted. And then somehow he sweet-talked her into transferring the deed to a building she owned in Fort Worth, Texas, to a man named Alexander Bond, who was actually Holmes. So by the end of 1895, now other things had happened, Minnie and her sister had vanished. Wonder where they went. Well, now here's what I can tell you. The police came in when he was gone in 1894, these hotel rooms, because there was a lot of scuttle around Chicago about disappearances and everything. They went to the second floor of his new building, and he was just not there, and they found rooms filled with torture equipment, hinged walls, false partitions, and rooms linked with secret passageways. And he even found some airtight rooms where you could that had holes where you could put gas in there, and they were connected to gas pipelines, which obviously were used for gas chambers. And he also had chutes where he could deliver the bodies. Now, we talked about Lavinia Fisher and that she could send bodies down to the basement. Well, he could send them down to the basement where he and some of his accomplices would take the skin off, and the ones that had problems with the skeletons, they would dump them in vats of lye and acid to remove any trace of what was going on. I mean, this was horrible. And they used medical tools to dissect the bodies, to pull out organs, to sell them on the black market. I think it's amazing that in the 1890s they were selling organs on the black market. I didn't even know that they had surgical techniques to do organ transplants back then. I didn't know that. So I maybe learned something. I don't know. But it was just horrible. So what happened was our boy H.H. Holmes left Chicago after he got bailed himself out, and he went to Texas to check out his inherited building from the Williams sisters who had vanished. So once he got down there, he contacted his buddy Pitzel and said, "Here's what we're going to do. You're going to pretend to die, and we're going to get a $10,000 insurance policy." He was also an insurance agent. I mean, this man was a CPA. He was a medical doctor. He was an insurance agent. He was a robber, thief, bigamist, and murderer, and an entrepreneur. I mean, you know, he had everything covered. He could have taught every class in a college. Just teasing. So anyway, he gets down there. He contacts Pitzel, and so Pitzel comes down there. And instead of faking the death, he burns Pitzel alive. So he actually has an autopsy done. The guy has died of being burnt up. So the money is a little bit of a hiccup because the insurance company smells a dirty rat and they don't pay off. But Holmes managed to get a couple of other payoffs. Now, those $10,000 insurance policies back then, that was like a $300,000 insurance policy today. That was a lot of money. And so what happened was the police finally got wise to it. He had captured another couple of ladies, and he was taking them around until he got their money and killed them. But the police caught him, and they got him. This is like Al Capone, who we talked about in our premiere episode. Capone was caught for one crime, and they put him in jail. That's all you have to do. You don't have to catch someone for 50 murders or 200 murders. You catch them for one, you can put them in jail. So, and they put him in jail for the murder of Ben Pitzel, and they sentenced him to death. Now, I want to respond to Robin's comment. He stated this, H.H. Holmes stated the following in jail. And this is one of the coldest, most awful things I've ever seen a criminal ever say. He stated, "I was born with the devil in me. I couldn't help the fact that I was a murderer, no more than a poet can help the inspiration to sing. I was born with the evil one standing as my sponsor beside me when I was ushered into the world, and he has been with me ever since." Robin, I believe he was correct, wasn't he?
Well, here's the thing. I want to point something out real quick. When
yes, ma'am.
I started to read this, and I had such a physical response to it, and I got that read on him that he was demonic, I did not even get through the entire first paragraph. Up until you just read this, I was not physically able to finish reading this. So the fact that it's in there, that that's what he said, I knew nothing about that till you just told me.
Well.
Because I felt like I could not breathe. And I have literally had this person in my head since that first paragraph, and he thinks this whole thing is funny. And he feels like pure evil.
Well, there's good in the world and the universe, and there's bad. Sometimes
well, this isn't just bad. There's a difference between bad and demonic.
I'm not saying bad. I'm talking about demonic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And we just.
But I just wanted to tell you, I hadn't heard that until you just read it.
It's not good. I mean, it's just as bad as it gets. I mean, you know, poor old Lavinia Fisher, who's portrayed as being the bad person, she was the one they wanted to steal her property. And poor old Lavinia, she may have been rough, but we don't think she was bad. And that was an interesting take. No, she wasn't. She was just rough. She was from the country. She was out there 10 miles from Charleston back in the day.
She was a bride.
And she was. And but you know, this guy is evil incarnate. And I think we're going to meet one more evil incarnate. Has anyone ever heard of Albert Fish?
Oh, yeah.
Devin, you ever heard of Albert Fish?
No, have not.
I haven't
either. He's horrible. Well, I tell you what, he's just about our boy H.H. Holmes' bro. I mean, you know, we're not talking about, you know, this is just... There have been some horrible people, and you know we talk about them because people. You know what? Someone said, "Why do you?" Today said, "Why do you do a show about bad people, murderers?" I said, "Well, you know what? The only way that you can really know good is understand a little bit about bad." And we're just being historical. We're not promoting bad. We're not promoting murder. But you know, people don't know about this stuff. There are times when. They're mitigating factors. I mean, I still kind of think poor old Pee Wee Gaskins was, you know, when you're raped from the time you're in reform school until 18.
He was a victim of his environment and circumstances that happened to him.
Yeah, and I don't care. You know, I do care. Dr. Trey Donaway said that a bottle full of kerosene wouldn't really mess you up, but I just can't imagine that being it's not a good thing. And his mom treated him
like
with, pure hell.
With Pee-wee, it was a matter of all that pent-up anger and hatred he had after what was done to him repeatedly, and nobody stuck up for him. Nobody tried to help him. I think it was all the mental abuse he went through.
That is exactly, I believe that too. And, you know, if you have all that happening to you, it's not right if you do a bad thing, but, you know, a reason is a reason. And
well, it's a matter of that way you can understand where it came from. You don't have to like it. You don't have to approve of it. And it doesn't change the severity of the crime, but at least you have insight as to why. Where with this person, this is just pure, unaltered evil.
Yes, it is, and it's horrible. But, you know, we know that, and you've certainly expressed your opinion, and we believe it. I mean, I know I believe it. Tony, so
yes.
Do you have any more comments you'd like to make about our boy of the evening, H.H. Holmes?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, during Holmes's murder spree was about the time that Jack the Ripper was active in London. And there have been some people try to draw the parallel that Holmes actually was out of the country for a bit and possibly could have been Jack the Ripper, but I find that kind of a stretch, but I find it interesting at the same time. But Holmes was the epitome of evil. I mean, whenever he took those children, he took them across country. He had those children write letters to their mother, you know, several ahead of time. You know, had them write a lot of letters. And he would send the letters after the children were dead to convince the mother that they were okay. I think he murdered, I'm not sure if he murdered one in Indiana, the boy maybe, one of the older boys. And then burnt them in a incinerated them in a stove. I think they found bits and pieces of bone in the human bone in the yard, maybe a little bit in the stove. And then the other two children he put in a trunk and stuck a run of hose from a gas light into the trunk and gassed those little babies. So this
yes.
guy was, the, to me, this one of the most despicable, evil people that's ever lived. No heart, no compassion, no nothing. Just he was all about killing, and he did use it as a business. But I think that he truly, truly enjoyed his work. And I hate to say this about as serial killers go, and I'm not making a cannibal joke. He had his cake and he ate it too, you know, because he made money off what he liked doing.
Well, we're not even sure that he wasn't a cannibal. We're not sure. I mean, nobody knows. I mean, and you know, and what was interesting, he really made a lot of money. He owned two buildings, three buildings. I mean, he had people's estates tied up. I mean, you know, it's just amazing what all he did.
Another thing, you know, whenever he had the murder castle going during the Chicago World's Fair, there were over 20 million people that attended the World's Fair. It may have been closer to 30 million, you know. So I find it hard to believe that Holmes just killed five or six people with all those folks coming into town. You know, there's a lot of people coming into town to see the World's Fair. And back in those days, if they did, you know, the way travel was, these folks may not have been expected home for two or three months, and they never showed back up. And there was no way to correlate, you know, like a missing persons report from all over
right.
the country. So I think that his he didn't go through the trouble of building the murder castle to kill six or eight folks.
No.
You know, there's no way. I mean, he built that knowing that the World's Fair was coming to Chicago, in my opinion. And this was a processing plant. And not only did he have this, but, you know, he had another place, I believe, in Chicago that that had incinerators that was for, and he had it under the guise of opening up a glass blowing business. So you got two different buildings you can access with incinerators, and you're not going to do that for 6 or 8 people. You're going to throw them in the river, or you're going to cut them up and boil them up and take the skeletons to the medical school, and nobody would have ever known. They never called it.
Well, I mean, I will say this, and this is one thing that when I read the story, he said he hired people to help him strip the skeletons of their flesh and their organs. Now, who knows what happened to those people?
I was just going to say, what kind of people would jump on the bandwagon with this? I mean, good Lord.
Well, hey, from what I understand, he gained their confidence, and it was like, they didn't think he would do it to them because he was healthy. And even the last one that he got that he worked with was Pfizer, whatever his name was.
Yeah.
Fitzer. And the reason that the police got on him was that he built a guy out of $500 on a insurance scam, and he put him on his trail.
Now, I'm sorry, say that again.
How did Holmes ended up getting caught, I believe, was that while he was in jail, that he concocted a scheme with a fellow inmate to do another insurance fraud, and he promised the guy $500, and that he didn't pay up, and this guy ratted him out and put him on his trail. You know, I could be wrong on that, but it seems
no.
Like
you're actually correct, because that inmate was at the very end of his 25-year term, and that inmate put Holmes onto an attorney that would help him be crooked and do these things. That's how it worked out. And ultimately, the attorney and this other convict got together, and they became a little afraid of what Holmes might do to them, because they started realizing everybody that's associated with this guy is vanishing, and he's got an acid vat at the bottom of his buildings. Gee, I mean, you know.
Really creepy.
It can't get any. This is like House on Haunted Hill, which took place in Los Angeles, Devin. But Devin, if you have any more recollections from that book, I would love for us to hear them, because that was really cool how you talked about all the inventions and, of course, the Skywheel in Myrtle Beach. Just teasing. But from that book, do you have any more interesting recollections? I think it's great that you read that book and you can bring this stuff to us that we don't know. We're going to have to get it, and I'm going to have to do a summary of the book, because this is going to make a great follow-up episode. So do you have anything else you can remember and share with us?
You know, I remember something about how he had, you know, you mentioned he had married multiple women. He had, you know, basically households or, you know, families with different women. And I remember at one point, I think in the book it talks about how one of them was like one or two blocks apart from each other. So they had no idea that he was going to both houses, you know, to like drop it and make his appearances. So he was crazy.
Yes, sir.
I mean, he was really a good con man too. He really knew how to game insurance companies and people, and you know, he just kind of knew how to like make things work in his favor.
That's true. In fact, I think what I read was the ladies were two blocks apart at one point. So it was kind of easy for him to come and go. I mean, if you're trying to have two marriages, it's pretty good if you're just a couple blocks apart. And
right.
I think one was they were both very close to Canada, if I remember correctly. And I mean, he was just like, I mean, he was the man. I mean, he was he was out there all over. Not the man, like I'm saying he was great, but I mean he really knew how to game the system. And it's a shame that you couldn't take all that brilliance. That's brilliant that you couldn't take that to do some good. I mean, he was a CPA, he was a doctor, he was everything. And I mean, it's like he could have done, that man could have done so much good for the world. God, he could have been president at the time he was 40. I mean, so, you know, you just never know. But yeah, H.H. Holmes was absolutely, in the literal sense, a monster. He's one of the few people that I believe we could legitimately call him that. Is that Tony next?
Yes. Didn't his cousin die when he was a child under mysterious circumstances while they were out playing or something? Didn't she drown or something like that?
Well, why in the heck do you think he left Vermont? Why do you think he left Vermont?
And this was when he was like 13 years old or something, wasn't it, that she died? They were close to the same age, and they think that was his first murder, was his cousin.
Yeah, actually, I think it was like, I think it was 14, because then he finished high school at 17. He was a high school teacher. But yeah, and then he left immediately when the noose got kind of tight around him. And I think now I can finish out this story, and I think everybody will take a shudder. Robin, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Until he was hanged, he remained fairly calm and polite and really didn't show any sign of fear or anxiety or depression. Instead of this, he asked that his coffin be encased in cement and buried 10 feet deep, because he was concerned grave robbers would steal his body and dissect it and sell the parts. Now, when the flooring for the gallows was pulled away, his neck didn't snap. He strangled to death slowly, twitching for over 15 minutes before being pronounced dead 20 minutes after the trap had been sprung. And I mean, he started paying his price then, and we don't know where he is now. It can't be a good place.
I think we have a good idea.
Yeah, he's not playing a harp and didn't get fitted for a halo, I don't think.
No, he didn't.
He was called home to his maker.
Yeah, exactly. I hope
he likes it. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, I've never, you know, until I started researching H.H. Holmes, I honestly never found somebody who had no redeeming value. I mean, none. Zero. I mean, we're talking about zero. And, you know, you can look at those that have 100% redeeming value in religion, the great founders of religion and everything. But then I finally found one that has zero redeeming value. And I have a feeling that when we talk about, I'll wait for a month or two before we hit on it, on Albert Fish, because I think Albert was just about as bad. We don't even put Pee Wee Gaskins in this same crew. But anyway, it's been interesting. Here's what I'd like to do. We've come to the end of our very sad story about one of the most frightening men that ever lived on this planet. And I would like to let everybody have an opportunity to talk about this, and then we will have another one for the records. So we'll do ladies first, of course. It'll be Robin, and then we'll ask Devin, and then we'll ask Tony. So, Robin, comments on the one and only H.H. Holmes.
Well, and maybe I missed this when everybody was talking, so I'm going to repeat it again. In the beginning, when it was, you know, you were first talking about him, he had a son. And then nothing else was said. But then it showed up later that wherever he went, he took this little boy with him. So are we safe to assume that he murdered a son, which would not be surprising as far as this type of evil?
We're
but
not
I mean,
safe
it
to
sounds,
thinking.
No, but I mean, it says that he married his first wife, Clara, and they had a son. But then it never mentions them again, except it does say that the couple moved to New York. He was known to be frequently in the company of a small boy. But then if you read on further, Herman told everybody that this child went back to his family in Massachusetts. Where in this little, I mean, exactly when did he off his own kid? Because he probably did. The chances of him not of killing his child are zero. And some of these wives, it doesn't say that they were actually killed, but if you look at the track record, their chance of survival was zero.
It seems like the only people that survived were really his business partners, except for Pitzker. So, you know, don't know. And that's why we really have no idea how many people he murdered, because he had those vats of acid that he could dump the bodies in and just, you know, nobody would know. So this, you know, H.H. Holmes, the meanest murderer
yeah.
that ever lived, perhaps the meanest. We can't ever say, but, you know, whatever. All right. Well, look, thank you for that observation. And we will pay for all the people that he murdered. They came to an untimely
yeah.
death, and it was horrible. All right.
It is, and they trusted him. That's the sad part. This was somebody that they trusted.
You see, it's cool to trust somebody and have them be good to you. It just is.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, there we go. That is Robin's take on H.H. Holmes. Devin Tate. What kind of a takeout do you have for tonight?
Well, I do wish I remembered a little bit more of the book. I have to tell Robin, you know, just to acknowledge that it, you know, he is a very dark subject. That's why I
yeah.
would recommend reading this book, The Devil in the White City, because it does juxtapose it with, like, a lot of really great stuff that's going on of people from all over the world coming to the World's Fair and kind of like that ingenuity of people inventing things and creating things. So it makes it a lot easier to kind of have to deal with the dark side of his story when you get to go back and forth between that. And as the Hollywood correspondent, I just wanted to tell you all that it's apparently being made into a series now by Hulu. I think Leonardo
yeah.
DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese are involved. So it could be another really interesting look at this whole ordeal.
Of H.H. Holmes?
Yeah, well, the series is based on the book, so it's about H.H. Holmes and also about the World's Fair.
Well, it'll either win an Emmy Award or it'll be terrible. And I hope it wins an Emmy. A good show about that would be rewarding to watch and to see what's going on. It really would. All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Hollywood correspondent. That's why we have you, because you know what's going on. So,
well,
I'm glad,
thank you.
Glad
yeah.
you're here. Even with your tooth, we're glad you're here. Tony Filosi from the Merciful of the World, Harlan, Kentucky. What you got to say?
I think H.H. Holmes' body count was way higher than what they claim is 26, 27, nine confirmed, 27, something like that he confessed to. I think that he used the World's Fair site as a hunting ground. There was nothing stopping him. He was engaging in, I think, as quickly as he could develop somebody and get them in there and gain their trust a little bit, they were doomed. And I think that people that went to his establishment looking for a room, I doubt very few of them ever made it out alive. I think that the police, whenever they found some of the airtight rooms, I think he had some safes too, or something similar to a safe, and he would smother his victims. They would walk in, and he would shut the door, and they were like, they found fingernails and stuff where people had tried to claw their way out. So I think also he, I can't hardly put my finger on the reason that he wanted the cement and things. I know that he didn't want his body desecrated like he had desecrated others.
Yeah.
But what does that what does that tell you about him? I mean, that so that out of all the things to throw a serial killer of this magnitude, he did not want the same thing done to him after
the
death of what he did to his victims. Yeah, yeah. So there was something, you know, I mean, he feared that. He feared
well,
that.
Well, he should.
So,
well.
I mean, in close, I just think he was one of the most evil people
yep.
I've ever read about.
Yes, he was, I think. And I'll close with this thought. My initial reaction is that he killed over 600 people. That's a gigantic number. That's a World's Fair number. And, you know, if you got people coming in and every other family, you just throw them in the airtight room and just turn the gas on, and they're gone. And he was making a lot of money. He was really making a lot of money.
27 million people he had to choose from. So, I mean, you know that he just didn't stop. He just didn't.
No, and that's why I think the number could be like 600. And just that's a production number because he had a production facility to kill people. So, anyway, we now know the depths of depression. We now know about H.H. Holmes. Devin, do be sure I will talk to you after this episode, because we have some more enlightening things to talk about, and I want to get that book, and I want to suggest that we all read it, and especially if there's going to be a series on Hulu about it. I think we'll all have a great time talking about that and all that. So thank you for bringing that up. I'm so glad that you did. And of course, going around the room, ladies first. Robin, thank you for being with us on Murder 123.
Of course. Take care, everybody.
We will. And Tony Pelosi, thank you for being with us on Murder 123.
Thank you so much. The hour flown by. This was just really great.
All righty. And of course, Devin, thank you very much. So glad to have you back after your dental work. And
thank you.
Hopefully we'll all be back next week with another amazing story of Murder 123. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time. Take care.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody. See you, Devin. See you, Robin. See you, John.
Bye.